very much for accepting the appointment. Next case for argument, United States versus Esterman, Mr. Marinelli.
May it please the court. Your honors, Mr. Esterman was charged with 4 counts of money laundering when all he did was spend somebody else's money. A money laundering statute is not a spending statute. It is a specific intent statute that requires that the defendant design to conceal the funds. In this case, there's no evidence that Mr. Esterman designed to conceal the source of the funds.
Does it matter from whom he's concealing the funds? Is it enough if he's just trying to conceal from the victim where the funds are now located?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that that's enough, but he certainly didn't conceal from Mr. Slavakosov that he took the funds. In fact, before he wrote the 4 checks that the government charges as money laundering, he already admitted to Mr. Slavakosov that he had taken the funds.
He admitted that he'd taken it, but he didn't say where they were. He didn't say, and by the way, I put them in my Michigan Avenue corporate bank account, did he?
No, he didn't, Your Honor. That's true, but those transactions, the transfers from Mr. Slavakosov's account are entirely traceable. And they're traceable from the Eden's Bank account to his Michigan Avenue account. And then he wrote checks out of the Michigan Avenue account, which were signed by Mr. Esterman, and entirely traceable. This is in the case where he was generating drug proceeds in cash and then funneling those cash proceeds through another account. These are completely open and notorious transactions, which courts have stated in several cases. In the Rockelman case, Dobbs, and McGahee, and Schaub cases, the defendant transferred funds to an illegitimate bank account and drafted checks out of that bank account.
But now, that's why I'm asking who the concealment has to be directed toward, because it seems to me quite plausible on your theory that the IRS isn't, you know, out in the dark. I mean, he's got certain bank accounts. He presumably has ID numbers associated with them, and maybe other people could know this, but it seems that Mr. Slavakosov might not have known about all the accounts without expending a huge amount of effort anyway to trace things down the line. So if it's insufficient as a matter of law that it's, quote, only the victim, that's one thing, but if it's okay that it's the victim, then that seems to be perhaps another question.
Well, Your Honor, true, Mr. Slavakosov may not have very easily been able to detect where the funds went, but he knew that they were taken. And Mr.
Right.
Esterman was not concealing that fact.
Right.
In another case, for example, in United States versus Dobbs, for example, the defendant transferred funds that were the collateral of a government loan, and the government surely didn't know where those funds came from. But the court still decided that was not an intent to conceal because those transactions were open and notorious, which is exactly the case here.
How do you distinguish trust?
Well, in trust, Your Honor, the defendant was the county recorder, and he opened an account especially and for the sole purpose of tricking the bank and everybody else that he was rightfully receiving those funds. There's no evidence in Mr. Esterman's case that he opened the Michigan Avenue account the purpose of concealing the funds. That is not the case here, and that's why trust is distinguishable. And Your Honor, the other thing I'd like to mention is that another fact where Mr. Esterman didn't design to conceal the source of the funds was that he made approximately 33 transactions out of Mr. Slavakosov's account. Only 5 of those transactions were transfers to his Michigan Avenue bank account. The vast majority, 30 of the transactions, were directly out of Mr. Slavakosov's account. And when you consider somebody...
They were just kind of spending money?
He was spending money.
Going around to spend?
And the fact that he did it in 5 of these transactions through his Michigan Avenue account does not evidence an intent to conceal. It's obvious he was just spending money in whatever way he could. And that's, in fact, what he was doing here, without any intent to launder the money.
What about the vulnerable victim point? It seems to me that, in fact, the district court judge wasn't just saying this is a Russian speaker, therefore he's vulnerable. He relied on quite a few factors, including just the sheer distance and the inability to catch up with Mr. Esterman, even when he sent his envoy there. Somehow or another, all the various tools at his disposal weren't enough to prevent that last $300,000 from being taken.
Well, Your Honor, Judge Shader certainly did focus and zero in directly on the fact that Mr. Savaksov didn't understand English. In fact, Judge Shader said that vulnerability is not a function of circumstance. He says it's a function of circumstance. Vulnerability is a function of the victim.
Well, it's a fact question, right? So don't we review his overall conclusion for clear error only?
That's true, Your Honor. And Mr. Judge Shader's overall conclusion should have been, and he should have considered the fact that Mr. Savaksov was a wealthy businessman who was engaged in a multi-million dollar deal in Russia. He showed his ability to protect himself from the law. He hired an attorney, filed a criminal complaint, filed a civil suit against Mr. Esterman, and he faxed the bank. He received his bank records from the bank. He called the bank using a Russian interpreter and then spoke to the bank using somebody at the bank who spoke Russian. He showed an ability.
Seems to have a certain amount of muscle, too. A lot to have a vulnerable victim who has these, makes these threats and so on.
He certainly does, Your Honor. And
this
fellow, this
emissary that he sent, I wonder how burly this man is. When he comes to Mr. Esterman and says he wants his money back.
I don't know, Your Honor, but the actions certainly don't comport with the victim who is unusually vulnerable, which is the requirement under the statute.
Well, the one thing you said about Savaksov in your reply brief struck me as mistaken. You said that because there's some question about the legality of Savaksov's money, you say on page 21, well, you put it stronger than that, put it more strongly. You say because the money was not Savaksov's, Esterman could not have stolen and laundered it. Well, that's not true. You can certainly steal from a thief. You're still a thief. You don't have immunity to commit theft against thieves. One thing is maybe if you take the money and return it to the victim, I suppose that's something, but just to take the money from one thief, steal from a thief, and spend the money on yourself, you're a thief.
Well, Your Honor, I think what's more poignant is that Mr. Esterman admitted to Mr. Savaksov that he took the money. You know, whether who was the thief is not important. The fact is that he didn't conceal that he took the money. Mr. Savaksov was well aware of that fact. And so were the banks, because all the transactions were open and notorious. Your Honor, I'd like to move to my final point, which is the obstruction of justice point. Mr. Esterman did not obstruct justice. Mr. Esterman was not in control of his financial situation. And there's no evidence in the record, and the record doesn't support the fact that to show that Mr. Esterman intentionally misled a probation officer.
Well, was it not possible for the district court to draw an inference from the differing stories that were presented about exactly what he was earning and what his assets were? The numbers did fluctuate, that this was an intentional act on his part?
No, Your Honor, that conclusion would be impermissible, because the probation officer did not do her job in determining that Mr. Esterman was in control of his financial situation. And Judge Shader should have recognized that. The probation officer didn't ask Mr. Esterman, those paintings on your wall, where did you get those? And in fact, Mr. Esterman didn't hide the paintings. He didn't report them in his asset statement, but there certainly weren't nail holes in the wall showing that he had taken them off the wall and hidden them. Mr. Esterman was a confused person as far as his finances were concerned. And he didn't. And they had a family-owned business. He didn't draw a salary.
Something just smells so strange in this case. It's really a venture to build a facility to manufacture intravenous solutions in Russia. There's got to be a lot more here that we don't know about.
Well, Your Honor, I have the same feeling you do. But, you know, based on the record that at trial, this is a story that we have to go by. There may be something more to this than...
Yeah, we might have to go by it, but it sure doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve my final minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Marinelli. Mr. King?
morning, Your Honors. Patrick King on behalf of the United States. I'm here to ask you to affirm the findings of the district court. Mostly, the totality of the evidence was sufficient for the jury to reasonably infer that the defendant's transactions were at least in part designed, calculated, to...
But now, would you make the same argument if he'd spent all the money out of the joint account?
No, I wouldn't.
So the critical thing is that he transferred some of his money to another account?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is that? What does that show? I don't get that. Well, a small amount of the money. So since he's spending a great deal of the joint account on his personal expenses, it's obvious to anyone who investigated that he's, you know, misappropriating this money. What difference does he make if he puts some of it in another account? People are constantly switching money back and forth between their bank accounts. I don't see how an inference of intention to conceal arises just from that or from anything else the fellow did.
I think maybe the fact which might crystallize this the best is that the jury could have seized, and it was reasonable for the jury to infer there was no logical basis for the defendant to transfer the money to the Michigan Avenue National Bank when he had basically free rein of the money while it was in the Edens Bank.
But as they say, people are, you know, constantly moving money back and forth from one account to another, sometimes higher interest rate that they get or whatever. The only thing, it seems to me, we have here is this fellow is engaged in criminal activity, and he happens to move a little bit of money from one account where he's spending freely to another. I don't see why that in itself suggests anything.
Can I, if I might, Your Honor?
What's the motive? How would he, by what, moving a small amount of this money into another account, how would that throw anybody off the scent, whether it's Savakasov or the police or anybody?
May I make 2 points with respect to that? First of all, the amount of money that was placed into the Edens account was in the ballpark of $600,000. I believe it was
the joint account.
Into the Edens bank account.
Right. That's the joint account.
Part of the fraud. Of that amount of money, 33 transactions come out in which the defendant writes directly to himself, his wife, other payees, and one check to the Devon pawn shop. Of the $600,000, approximately $300,000 of it he transfers in separate transactions into the Edens bank account. So the amount of money that he was attempting to launder.
But now I've lost you. The Edens account, is this a joint account?
The Edens account is the joint account between
with
the victim
Savakasov.
And Mr. Savakasov, the victim.
You said it had $600,000 in it. So how much went to
Michigan
Avenue National Bank? Approximately $300,000 of it, Judge. In three separate transactions, it's moved over. And from the amount of money that is moved to the second bank, of which Mr. Savakasov has no knowledge and no reason to know of, there are three checks which are charged, made by the defendant to other payees.
Why is that not just spending the money, though? I mean, it's still his bank account, and I guess I have a real problem understanding how that converts it into money laundering, which is, you know, of course, a federal offense, and anytime we federalize offenses, we need to think about what we're doing. And I just don't see why spending out of account A versus account B means that it's been laundered.
I think the crucial analysis is that there was no reason for him, if he spent 30 out of the 33 transactions, spending it directly out of the joint account, there was no reason for him to transfer it to the Michigan Avenue National Bank, but
maybe
for...
It's like having all his money in one bank. But now, what is there? Okay, so... If Savakasov looked at the account in the Edens Bank, he'd see, you know, money being paid out for a pawn shop and so on. So he'd know something was fishy, a lot of other personal expenses. And he'd also see $300,000 transferred to another bank. So How did that transfer of the $300,000 conceal something from Sivakov that leaving it in the Edens account wouldn't have?
First of all, it isn't necessarily just concealing it from Sivakov. It's the defendant's
intent
to conceal it from anyone.
From like who? And I mean, what are you talking about?
One practical consequence
of
this.
What's the concealment? If the police look, they see a check to a pawn shop or something, and a bunch of other personal things. They also see a $300,000 check or whatever, or a series of transfers to another bank. So they go to the other bank. What's the...
And from there, it's gone to individuals who you may not find, Mr. Alexander.
That would be the same if the checks were made out on the Edens Bank, right? You write a check to someone who's some unknown nobody. So what difference does it make who the unknown gets the money from, the Michigan account or the Edens account?
Because it obfuscates it to anyone
no,
who
it doesn't.
Wishes to look.
I don't see the obfuscation. What's the obfuscation?
For the man who lives...
I'm investigating, okay? And so I see all these suspicious disbursements from the Edens account, and I see half the money went to another bank. So I go to the other bank, and I look in that account, and I see a bunch of other questionable personal expenditures. What's the difference? If you were going to conceal something, you certainly do, you know, change your name or do something.
Well, you funnel it through a car wash or, you know, promote, you know, concert tickets or something. You do something that allows the money to join some flow of seemingly legitimate money.
What's the difference here between if a drug dealer took $5,000 of drug proceeds, put it in his bank account, and then went out and bought something and wrote a check for $5,000. It's not money laundering.
It's the additional step of transferring it to the second financial institution, and I don't think we can divorce ourselves from the fact that the victim in this case is so far removed unlikely to determine.
There's kind of an element of humor to the vulnerable, because we usually think of the vulnerable victim as someone who's weak. And this guy, you know, it's a typical Russian business. I mean, I think it was okay to keep this stuff from the jury about the threats. But, you know, these are tough guys, and he's got money. And I assume he could have gotten an order. I mean, the fact that he sent this fellow and took 4 days and missed a chance to intercept the money... The inference that occurs to me is that while he could easily have gotten a lawyer in Chicago to freeze the account, he thought it more effective to send some tough guy to lean on Esterman and make clear Esterman had better come up with that money. He's going to be in really bad, worse trouble than he can get into with the police. It's only months later that he, having failed in this, that Sivakov's lawyer calls the police. What's the vulnerability? Is every foreign businessman a vulnerable victim per se?
No, I don't think it is a per se. It's based upon the particular facts and the totality of the facts.
But this is a rich Russian, so I don't know why he... I can see how a foreign businessman might be taken over the barrel by an American, but I don't see that here.
This particular individual... As Judge Shader found, the evidence clearly supports his finding that he had a lack of knowledge of the English language, he had a lack of knowledge of the business system. He is growing up in a culture that is completely different than ours, with the questions of access to the courts, access to the banks, access to legal remedies. I mean, it is a much different circumstance. He may, in his own realm, be not vulnerable. But when you take him and put him in a different country where he knows nothing of the language or customs, or nothing of
methods. But also, Americans, most Americans don't know a single foreign language, and they do business all over the world. Because if you're a businessman, I mean, it's not as if he's some little person. He's by Russian standards, he's a prosperous capitalist. And he knows that if he deals in the United States, he'll have to have someone helping him who knows English. So he got a lawyer in Chicago. That was no big deal.
It took him a long
time. Yes, but I think that as far as this record indicates to me, he thought he had a better way of getting the money from Esterman. Especially if there is some sort of cloud over his money, he may not have wanted to get involved with the American legal system if he could collect the money through informal means.
I see
anything here that indicates that he's some you know, some helpless waif being deep.
I see I'm out of time, but I'd be willing to answer your question
sure.
if you'd like. I think the notion that this is somehow illegal money is completely belied by the fact that ultimately when he finds out he can use a lawyer, he does avail himself of a lawyer and uses the judicial process to attempt to get a judgment.
I didn't say it was illegal. I just said he probably doesn't want to expose all his affairs to American legal system. After all, one consequence of his not being able to get the money informally is that we now have this criminal case in which we learn about, I mean, these are rumors and so on, but about his threatening to kill Esterman. And of course, Esterman's lawyer is accusing Savakov of being a thief. So I don't think he probably has enjoyed his relation with the American legal system that much. So, but I don't see this vulnerable victim thing has a, there's a risk of it's just expanding because every criminal tries to take advantage of someone who has some kind of vulnerability. You don't go after the toughest, most sophisticated person in the world. So you've made the kind of argument here, or the district judge has spun the kind of web here that would make everyone a vulnerable victim.
I think it was the finding that this particular person met the
defendant. In fact, Esterman is so inept at money laundering that the only people he could, because by definition, every victim of Esterman would have to be vulnerable in your sense. You have to be unsophisticated. It's stupid to open a joint account with someone so who can just drain it out. So that's a vulnerable victim.
The defendant was startled and stunned when the victim learned that the money had been taken. The record is clear that he never expected the victim to learn that the balance had been reduced, to find out that money had been taken from the account. And when he has that conversation on the phone with the victim in rural Russia and Esterman in New York City, Esterman A, denies that it happened, attempts to delay any effort to have the person try and find it, and only as a last resort admits that, well, I have it, but come here, we'll meet, we'll talk about it, come in a couple of weeks. And sending the emissary was not to threaten the defendant, but as much as to try and rescue the money because the money couldn't, the bank told the victim, the money could not be reversed, it couldn't go back, the second wire transfer had to go into the bank account at Eden's, so he sent someone to try and raise the deposit to come and get it out. That's the purpose that the record establishes for which Andrei Skorokov was sent there.
Mm-hmm.
At a subsequent date, he goes to ask for the money back. He obtains a promissory note from the defendant, and there's recorded conversations. And as far as the threats go, there's threats back and forth between the two of them. Is I could whack you. Your life is worth nothing in a country like this. I think that's a wash. I don't think that really means anything to anybody.
It's a wash. I don't know. That makes them very vulnerable. Very threatening to kill each other. We don't usually think of the vulnerable victim as someone who is threatening to kill the criminal, right? Victim is someone who's intimidated. That's really the rationale for the enhancement is that a vulnerable person is less likely to complain and so on, if you want an adequate deterrence, you have to give a bonus. But if you're stealing from people who threaten to kill you, there's some built-in deterrence there. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. King. And Mr. Marinelli, how much time did you have? 1 minute? Or?
Your Honors, I would just like to go over United States versus Jackson, the case out of this circuit, to illustrate the difference between what Mr. Esterman did and what is legally money laundering. In Jackson, the defendant took drug money, illegal proceeds generated from drug sales. He was a clergyman. He deposited it into his church account. He took then out of that church account, he had his secretary write checks to cash and send the secretary over to a bank to cash the checks. That's money laundering. That's money laundering out of an account of a legitimate business. Mr. Esterman didn't do any of that. He was open and notorious. He didn't hide behind a third party. He wasn't hiding cash. Everything was completely traceable, and all he was doing was spending money.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Marinelli. And you were appointed, were you not?